The first thing I thought of doing in relation to this work was to find an anthology of American aspirational thought and subject it to chance operations. I thought the resultant complex would help to change our present intellectual climate. I called up Dover and asked whether they published such an anthology. They didn't. I called a part of Columbia University concerned with American history and asked about aspirational thought. They knew nothing about it. I called the information desk of the New York Public Library at 42nd Street. The man who answered said, "You may think I'm not serious, but I am. If you're interested in aspiration, go to the Children's Library on 52nd Street." I did. I found that anthologies for children are written by adults. They're what adults think are good for children. The thickest one was edited by Commager, Documents of American History. It is a collection of legal judgments, presidential reports, congressional speeches. I began to realize that what is called balance between the branches of our government is not balance at all. All the branches of our government are occupied by lawyers. Of all professions, the law is the least concerned with aspiration. It is concerned with precedent, not with discovery, with what was witnessed at one time in one place, and not with vision and intuition. When the law is corrupt, it is corrupt because it concentrates its energy on protecting the rich from the poor. Justice is out of the question. That is why not only aspiration, but intelligence, as in the work of Buckminster Fuller, and conscience, as in the thought of Thoreau, are missing in our leadership. Our leaders are concerned with the energy crisis. They assure us they will find new sources of oil. Not only will Earth's reservoir of fossil fuels soon be exhausted, their continued use continues the ruin of the environment. Our leaders promise they will solve the unemployment problem. They will give everyone a job. It would be more in the spirit of Yankee ingenuity, more American, to find a way to get all the work done that needs to be done without anyone's lifting a finger. Our leaders are concerned with inflation and insufficient cash. Money, however, is credit, and credit is confidence. We have lost confidence in one another. We could regain it tomorrow by simply changing our minds. Therefore, even though the occasion for this piece is the bicentennial of the USA, I have chosen to work again with the writings of Henry David Thoreau. Those excerpts which are used were not selected to stress any particular points, but were obtained by means of E. King chance operations from Walden, from the Journal, and from the Essay on Civil Disobedience. Thoreau lived not 200 years ago, but for 44 years only, beginning 159 years ago. In 1968, I wrote as follows. Reading Thoreau's journal, I discover any idea I've ever had worth its salt. In 1862, Emerson wrote, "No truer American existed than Thoreau. If he brought you yesterday a new proposition, he would bring you today another, not less revolutionary." In 1929, Gandhi wrote that he had found the Essay on Civil Disobedience so convincing and truthful that as a young man in South Africa preparing to devote his life to the liberation of India, he had felt the need to know more of Thoreau and so had studied the other writings. In 1958, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote these words, "As I thought further, I came to see that what we were really doing was withdrawing our cooperation from an evil system, rather than merely withdrawing our economic support from the bus company. The bus company, being an external expression of the system, would naturally suffer. but the basic aim was to refuse to cooperate with evil. At this point, I began to think about Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience. I remembered how, as a college student, I had been moved when I first read this work. I became convinced that what we were preparing to do in Montgomery was related to what Thoreau had expressed. We were simply saying to the white community, we can no longer lend our cooperation to an evil system. On December 8, 1859, Thoreau himself wrote as follows. 200 years ago is about as great an antiquity as we can comprehend or often have to deal with. It is nearly as good as 2,000 to our imaginations. It carries us back to the days of Aborigines and the Pilgrims, beyond the limits of oral testimony, to history which begins already to be enameled with a gloss of fable, and we do not quite believe what we read, to a strange style of writing and spelling and of expression, to those ancestors whose names we do not know and to whom we are related only as we are to the race generally. It is the age of our very oldest houses and cultivated trees, nor is New England very peculiar in this. In England also, a house 200 years old, especially if it be a wooden one, is pointed out as an interesting relic of the past. I have wanted in this work to give another opportunity for us, whether of one nation or another, to examine again, as Thoreau continually did, ourselves, both as individuals and as members of society, and the world in which we live, whether it be concord in Massachusetts or discord in the world, as our nations apparently, for their continuance, as though they were children playing games, prefer to have it. It may seem to some that through the use of chance operations, I run counter to the spirit of Thoreau and 76 and revolution for that matter. The fifth paragraph of Walden speaks against blind obedience to a blundering oracle. However, chance operations are not mysterious sources of the right answers. They are a means of locating a single one among a multiplicity of answers, and at the same time of freeing the ego from its taste and memory, its concern for profit and power, of silencing the ego so that the rest of the world has a chance to enter into the ego's own experience, whether that be outside or inside. I have given this work the proportions of my silent piece, which I wrote in 1952, though I was already thinking of it earlier. When I was 12, I wrote a speech called Other People Think, which proposed silence on the part of the USA as preliminary to the solution of its Latin American problems. Even then, our industrialists thought of themselves as the owners of the world, of all of it, not just the part between Mexico and Canada. Now our government thinks of us also as the policemen of the world, no longer rich policemen, just poor ones, but nonetheless on the side of the good and acting as though possessed of the power. The desire for the best and the most effective in connection with the highest profits and the greatest power led to the fall of nations before us. Rome, Britain, Hitler's Germany, those were not chance operations. We would do well to give up the notion that we alone can keep the world in line, that only we can solve its problems. More than anything else, we need communion with everyone. Struggles for power have nothing to do with communion. Communion extends beyond borders. It is with one's enemies also. Thoreau said, the best communion men have is in silence. Our political structures no longer fit the circumstances of our lives. Outside the bankrupt cities, we live in megalopolis, which has no geographical limits. Wilderness is Global Park. I dedicate this work to the USA, that it may become just another part of the world. No more, no less.
You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and we've just listened to John Cage reading the preface to his lecture on the weather, a work that we chose to perform in the first year the John Cage Trust joined the ranks of Bard College in 2007. As I said in my opening remarks to our performances, we did the work twice, making subtle changes to our cast from the first performance to the second. There were many opportunities afforded to us at Bard, not least of which were the many opportunities to perform and for Cage's works to be seen and heard in the beautiful Fisher Center for the Performing Arts. This was our inaugural event, and I entitled my opening remarks, Why Twice? I've chosen to open our program tonight with this preface because of its aspirational tone, which for many provides strength, courage, and sanity when we seem to have very little of this around us. Also for its prescience, which makes me want to listen to him again and again. I'm going to share a few of my thoughts as I shared them that day, surrounded as I was by not only Cage's work, but by the many inspired performers who came together to perform it. The performers for our 2007 presentation at Bard College were as follows. When those performers were Bard students, their names are followed by their impending year of graduation. John Ashbery, Leon Botstein, Casey Brazeau, class of 2009, Merce Cunningham, Sage Fuller Coles, Ari Fenton, class of 2008, Daniel Fishkin, class of 2009, John Kelly, Kevin Close, Gary Kvistad, Robert Martin, Sean Patrick Moore, class of 2010, Michael Rouse, John Ralston Saul, Tristan Shepard, class of 2009, Richard Teitelbaum, and Zeke Verrant, class of 2009. This is not a program about lecture on the weather, however, which I'm saving for a time when our dramaturg, Joan Retallick, who is also a Bard colleague, is free to join us. At that time, we'll also listen to one of the performances. It's really a program about Cage's warmth and sensibility. We'll close the program tonight with a reading by Cage of a far lesser known work entitled Other People Think, which makes it clear that he possessed these attributes at a very young age. But more about that later. John Cage's career as a composer lasted more than 60 years, spanning from the early 1930s until his death in 1992. In those years, he navigated a course of composition that included tight, formulaic serial compositions, percussion works, the musical domain in which noise is most welcome, works for prepared piano, an instrument of his own invention and for which he received an unsolicited and sorely needed Guggenheim Award, groundbreaking compositions involving electronics, radio, tape, and phonographs, theater pieces, radio plays, and a host of uncategorizable mixed media presentations, works for nearly every conceivable instrument and in combination, ranging from Steinberger bass guitar to symphony orchestra and even opera. He also wrote pieces for rocks, seashells, and plants, for toy pianos, rain sticks, for moving trains, for Scottish bagpipes, and Balinese gamelan. That list goes on and on. And of course, there's 433. A work for nothing or everything, depending on your point of view. Cage became best known, in some circles notoriously so, for his use of chance operations, a compositional practice which emanated in the very early 1950s out of his study of Eastern philosophies and especially Zen Buddhism. It was a compositional practice with a strong spiritual and philosophical basis. Cage used chance procedures as a means toward self-discovery, of overcoming his own tastes and biases and habits. But he also used chance as a means of discovering, both in himself and in those for whom he composed, how one might become more genuinely useful in the world, to oneself, to others, and to the larger complex environment that was, for him, the second half of the 20th century. Lecture on the Weather was born during a time in which Cage was not only firmly committed to the use of chance operations, but to theater. Seeing theater through his engagement of both the eye and the ear as having the potential of serving as a kind of microcosm of society. How do we behave in groups? How might we better behave in groups? What might be posited in theatrical performance as a useful example of cohabitation? How might we see theatrical works composed with these questions in mind as practice zones for living? In some respects, Lecture on the Weather is an atypical work for Cage in its overtly political tone. It came about as a commission from the CBC in 1975, who wanted a work that would be in observance of America's bicentennial. Cage chose to create a piece that would engage as performers 12 expatriate American men who had settled in Canada during the Vietnam War. As you will hear in his reading of the preface, Cage took this work as an opportunity to articulate his dissatisfaction with American government. His observations are noteworthy, both for the sentiments expressed, which are prescient and still timely from our current perspective, but also that he said them out loud. By the end of his life, Cage didn't really favor critical response, preferring instead something more creative. If you find you don't like something, he said, the proper response, in his view, would be to make something better. But Cage's preface to Lecture on the Weather is not the only place a political statement is being made. What Cage also did, here and elsewhere, was to embed political ideas into the very forms and practices of his compositions. Works from the 1950s, all variously conceived with chance means, always comprise a delicate balance between what he called law elements and what he called freedom elements. Law elements where he felt they were needed, freedom elements everywhere else. Which leads me to the intent of my 2007 talk, which was to give the audience a glimpse into how these law and freedom elements inhabit Lecture on the Weather. Because it's the interplay of these elements of law and of freedom, that to my mind provided the rationale for performing two iterations of this work back to back on the same night. Both law and freedom elements of this work are apparent in nearly any description of it. One law element, for example, is the length of the piece itself, which may be as short as 22 minutes and 45 seconds, or as long as 36 minutes and 24 seconds, or sometime in between, as long as the length is divisible by 4 minutes and 33 seconds, the title and length, of course, of Cage's infamously silent piece. We chose to perform the work in both iterations for the maximum allowable time. This choice as to length within Cage's constraints is actually an example of a freedom element. Another law element is seen in the spoken materials of the work, which consist of a collection of conversational quotations by the great American naturalist Henry David Thoreau, to whom Cage was deeply devoted. As Cage's score tells us, each performer is given a fixed number of quotations by Thoreau, a number of which are to be removed prior to rehearsal and performance. For example, if a given part has 12 quotations by Thoreau, the performer of that part might be asked by Cage to remove 6, leaving only 6 to be read. Which particular quotations to remove is a freedom element, since this is left to the performer's discretion. Also at the performer's discretion is how to remove those texts, by taste, by chance, or even in real time, during performance, by improvisational behavior. Once this is done, the performer has effectively created a unique working score. He or she then faces the job of deciding where to place the remaining texts within the performed work as a whole. Thus, freedom elements include both which quotations to perform out of a delimited whole and when to perform these quotations within the work as a whole. Another freedom element has to do with the tiny fragments of Thoreau's drawings that are embedded within many of the quotations. For those of you unfamiliar, this is a type of musical notation called graphic notation, which was peculiar to largely American composers in the 1960s into the 1970s, whereby performers are asked to translate, if you will, graphic imagery into musical sounds and behaviors. Here, these may be interpreted by the performers within the context of his or her reading of the associated text in any way desired, thereby enhancing, emboldening, obscuring, or extending any straight reading of the text into something more akin to music. Cage provides the barest of guidance as to how these graphic fragments might be interpreted, asking only that they be executed in a single breath or a single bow, thus ensuring a sense of continuity from one line to another within a given quotation, and reducing, with luck, extended flights of fancy by the performer. And to further thicken the plot, if a performer is choosing to both read and play an instrument, then the possibilities for realizing the graphic notation broaden further. The notation can be vocally intoned, or it can be interpreted via one's instrument. And in the case of the vocalist instrumentalist, one can also choose between intoning and playing graphic notation throughout the course of the work, alternating at will from one quotation to the next. One more thing to mention about this work, which is implicit in its title, is its homage to the environment. The sound score for Lecture on the Weather was composed and performed by Marianne Amiche, who was the subject of a program several weeks ago here on All Things Cage. Amiche realized this aspect of the work with John Cage. She mixed in real time the simulated weather sounds one hears throughout the work, which move dramatically and choreographically from breeze through rain to thunder. And weather itself, as we all well know, has in the 21st century become extremely political. I posed the title of my pre-performance talk as a question. Why twice? I hope that it has been at least implicitly answered through a description of how the piece was made to work. Given the freedom elements, cohabitating as they do with law elements, no two performances of Lecture on the Weather can ever be quite the same. Let's listen to Cage reading of his preface one more time now that we know a little bit about the work that will follow.
The first thing I thought of doing in relation to this work was to find an anthology of American aspirational thought and subject it to chance operations. I thought the resultant complex would help to change our present intellectual climate. I called up Dover and asked whether they published such an anthology. They didn't. I called a part of Columbia University concerned with American history and asked about aspirational thought. They knew nothing about it. I called the information desk of the New York Public Library at 42nd Street. The man who answered said, "You may think I'm not serious, but I am. If you're interested in aspiration, go to the children's library on 52nd Street. I did. I found that anthologies for children are written by adults. They're what adults think are good for children. The thickest one was edited by Commager, Documents of American History. It is a collection of legal judgments, presidential reports, congressional speeches. I began to realize that what is called balance between the branches of our government is not balance at all. All the branches of our government are occupied by lawyers. Of all professions, the law is the least concerned with aspiration. It is concerned with precedent, not with discovery, with what was witnessed at one time in one place, and not with vision and intuition. When the law is corrupt, it is corrupt because it concentrates its energy on protecting the rich from the poor. Justice is out of the question. That is why not only aspiration, but intelligence, as in the work of Buckminster Fuller, and conscience, as in the thought of Thoreau, are missing in our leadership. Our leaders are concerned with the energy crisis. They assure us they will find new sources of oil. Not only will Earth's reservoir of fossil fuels soon be exhausted, their continued use continues the ruin of the environment. Our leaders promise they will solve the unemployment problem. They will give everyone a job. It would be more in the spirit of Yankee ingenuity, more American, to find a way to get all the work done that needs to be done without anyone's lifting a finger. Our leaders are concerned with inflation and insufficient cash. Money, however, is credit. And credit is confidence. We have lost confidence in one another. We could regain it tomorrow by simply changing our minds. Therefore, even though the occasion for this piece is the bicentennial of the USA, I have chosen to work again with the writings of Henry David Thoreau. Those excerpts which are used were not selected to stress any particular points, but were obtained by means of E. King chance operations from Walden, from the Journal, and from the essay on civil disobedience. Thoreau lived not 200 years ago, but for 44 years only, beginning 159 years ago. In 1968, I wrote as follows. Reading Thoreau's journal, I discover any idea I've ever had worth its salt. In 1862, Emerson wrote, "No truer American existed than Thoreau. If he brought you yesterday a new proposition, he would bring you today another, not less revolutionary." In 1929, Gandhi wrote that he had found the essay on civil disobedience so convincing and truthful that as a young man in South Africa preparing to devote his life to the liberation of India, he had felt the need to know more of Thoreau and so had studied the other writings. In 1958, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote these words, "As I thought further, I came to see that what we were really doing was withdrawing our cooperation from an evil system, rather than merely withdrawing our economic support from the bus company. The bus company, being an external expression of the system, would naturally suffer. But the basic aim was to refuse to cooperate with evil." At this point, I began to think about Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience. I remembered how, as a college student, I had been moved when I first read this work. I became convinced that what we were preparing to do in Montgomery was related to what Thoreau had expressed. We were simply saying to the white community, we can no longer lend our cooperation to an evil system. On December 8, 1859, Thoreau himself wrote as follows, 200 years ago is about as great an antiquity as we can comprehend or often have to deal with. It is nearly as good as 2,000, to our imaginations. It carries us back to the days of Aborigines and the Pilgrims, beyond the limits of oral testimony, to history which begins already to be enameled with a gloss of fable, and we do not quite believe what we read, to a strange style of writing and spelling and of expression, to those ancestors whose names we do not know and to whom we are related only as we are to the race generally. It is the age of our very oldest houses and cultivated trees, nor is New England very peculiar in this. In England also, a house 200 years old, especially if it be a wooden one, is pointed out as an interesting relic of the past. I have wanted in this work to give another opportunity for us, whether of one nation or another, to examine again, as Thoreau continually did, ourselves, both as individuals and as members of society, and the world in which we live, whether it be concord in Massachusetts or discord in the world, as our nations apparently, for their continuance, as though they were children playing games, prefer to have it. It may seem to some that through the use of chance operations, I run counter to the spirit of Thoreau and 76 and revolution for that matter. The fifth paragraph of Walden speaks against blind obedience to a blundering oracle. However, chance operations are not mysterious sources of the right answers. They are a means of locating a single one among a multiplicity of answers, and at the same time of freeing the ego from its taste and memory, its concern for profit and power, of silencing the ego so that the rest of the world has a chance to enter into the ego's own experience, whether that be outside or inside. I have given this work the proportions of my silent piece, which I wrote in 1952, though I was already thinking of it earlier. When I was 12, I wrote a speech called Other People Think, which proposed silence on the part of the USA as preliminary to the solution of its Latin American problems. Even then, our industrialists thought of themselves as the owners of the world, of all of it, not just the part between Mexico and Canada. Now our government thinks of us also as the policemen of the world. No longer rich policemen, just poor ones, but nonetheless on the side of the good and acting as though possessed of the power. The desire for the best and the most effective in connection with the highest profits and the greatest power led to the fall of nations before us. Rome, Britain, Hitler's Germany, those were not chance operations. We would do well to give up the notion that we alone can keep the world in line, that only we can solve its problems. More than anything else, we need communion with everyone. Struggles for power have nothing to do with communion. Communion extends beyond borders. It is with one's enemies also. Thoreau said, "The best communion men have is in silence." Our political structures no longer fit the circumstances of our lives. Outside the bankrupt cities, we live in megalopolis, which has no geographical limits. Wilderness is global park. I dedicate this work to the USA, that it may become just another part of the world, no more, no less.
Now on to a far lesser known and far earlier work, Other People Think. This was a text presented by John Cage in 1927 at the Hollywood Bowl, where Cage, representing Los Angeles High School, won the Southern California Oratorical Contest. He was 15 years old, and he would graduate the following year at the age of 16. This is obviously one of Cage's earliest text works, and it is a striking and provocative critique of U.S. relations with Latin America, a subject very much in the news at the time of its writing. Here's a telling paragraph. One of the greatest blessings that the United States could receive in the near future would be to have her industries halted, her businesses discontinued, her people speechless, a great pause in her world of affairs created, and finally, to have everything stopped that runs until everyone should hear the last wheel go around and the last echo fade away. Then, in that moment of complete intermission, of undisturbed calm, would be the hour most conducive to the birth of a pan-American conscience. Then we should be capable of answering the question, what ought we to do? For we should be hushed and silent, and we should have the opportunity to learn that other people think. Interesting to note Cage's pacifist position at such a young age, his policy suggestions throughout, and his use of silence as a metaphor, the last of great relevance at this historical moment. Cage's talk was first published in Richard Castellanets' anthology entitled simply John Cage, published by Prager Publishers as Documentary Monographs in Modern Art Series, 1970. It would be published decades later on its own by Alfredo Jarre, in homage to John Cage on the occasion of the 2012 John Cage Centennial, printed in a small booklet format in stark black and white in a limited edition of 1,000. The recording we'll listen to is of Cage's reading at the Los Angeles Festival on the occasion of his 75th birthday celebration in 1987. It was produced by Larry Stein.
I wrote this text when I was in the Los Angeles High School, and I read it at the Hollywood Bowl before an audience of 5 people. My mother had asked whether she could come, and I said it would embarrass me and that she should not come, but she was one of the 5. It's called Other People Think. When Washington was proclaimed President of the United States, our country possessed most of the territory between the Atlantic and the Mississippi River. After the Mexican War, the Stars and Stripes were flown from ocean to ocean, from the Gulf of Mexico to the Great Lakes. Today, the United States is a world power. In the New World, she calls Alaska, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands territories. She exerts a strong influence over Haiti, Nicaragua, Panama, and the Dominican Republic. She has circulated her dollar throughout the Latin American countries until she is spoken of as the giant of the North and thought of as the ruler of the American continent. Many citizens of this powerful nation have come to believe that people south of the Rio Grande are by nature inferior to those north of that river. A great number of Latin Americans, however, are convinced of their superiority to Anglo-Saxons. Both beliefs are justified to a certain degree, but both are the results of a superficial knowledge of racial characteristics and an unfortunate lack of mutual appreciation and sympathy. Neither people has been able to catch a convincing glance of the other's worth. There is a gulf of misunderstanding between the rulers and the ruled of the American continent, and little is done to span that gulf with bridges of harmony, although it is to the best interests of both peoples to do so. In the past, many obstacles have hindered the advancement of civilization among the Latin Americans. The men that colonized South America in contrast with the pilgrims of New England, were pleasure-loving, avaricious, and adventurous. Under Spanish dominion, they were never given the opportunity to develop self-government. Thus, they have found it difficult to maintain the sovereignty of their countries. Yet in their beginning to recognize their problems, they prophesy progress. Latin America is the land of the future. It is the potential producer of most of the food and raw products for all the world. Already, each of the 20 Latin American countries is noted for a product upon which the rest of the world is dependent. We rely on Brazil for our coffee, on Cuba for our sugar, and on Argentina for our wheat. These 20 countries also represent a market for the world's manufacturers. Without doubt, Latin America will experience a golden age in the near future. To cultivate friendly relations between North and South America will be a greater advantage mutually than it is at present or has ever been in the past. It is the popular belief that we have promoted friendly relations with all Latin America. Our foreign policy has, in general, aimed to promote the general welfare of the southern people. Without our intervention in Ecuador, that country, because of its unsanitary conditions, would be spilling its poison over all the New World. With the practice of American science, much of the dread of yellow fever in Central America has disappeared. Because of Uncle Sam's military power, Venezuela has been protected from Germany, Cuba from Spain, Mexico from France. We have defended all weak countries from European domination. We are governing Santo Domingo because the natives tried but failed. We are educating the Negroes of Haiti so that they may learn how to handle their own affairs. The United States has rid many countries of the curse of revolution. Many of the smaller republics have progressed in civilization because of American finance. Panama is Panama because of our interests in the canal. All in all, our intervention in Latin America has been actuated by altruistic motives. Why, then, is there any misunderstanding between the Latins and the Anglo-Saxons of this continent? There are two sides to every question, for other people think otherwise. Concerning the question of American intervention in Latin America, many people are thinking otherwise. The foremost literary men of the southern countries, led by Manuel Ugarte, are instructing their readers how to think. The professors of the great South American universities are teaching the students what to think. The statesmen, guided by Dr. Honorio Pueyrredon, are thinking and beginning to make their countries think. This thought that has penetrated the intellectual life of the Latin republics so effectively has been influenced by the actions of certain citizens of the United States. The great majority of these are capitalists who have zealously invested money in the southern republics and eagerly exploited them. They have not the hope of progress of others, but only the desire for their own material advancement. They are the family of the utterly selfish. They have not only been financially successful, they have succeeded in gaining for themselves the contempt and the aversion of men. They belong to a crazed congregation of gold worshippers, and it is difficult to convict them of wrongdoings, for they are extremely sly and hypocritical. These are our ambassadors to Latin America. In the eyes of the southern people, these men are the United States. These are the books in which Latin Americans read our history, the pictures which portray for them Anglo-Saxon ideals. 6 years ago, three American banking companies loaned $26 million to the Republic of Bolivia. It was provided in the contract that 10% of the principal should be paid annually in monthly installments, with the interest at 8%. In the case of a default on the part of the country, the bankers will be given complete control of the Bolivian National Bank, certain Bolivian railroads, and the revenues of the Republic. According to this contract of 1922, the government of Bolivia is forbidden to borrow other money without the consent of the American bankers. For the administration of these provisions and the supervision of Bolivian finances, a permanent fiscal commission was formed. It consists of three members appointed by the president of Bolivia, two of whom are recommended by the Americans. As a result, the economic future of Bolivia is subject to the will of a handful of bankers. This is, however, but one instance of the actions of American capitalists. There are ties that have fastened the hearts of every Latin American country inveterately with the counting houses of Wall Street. It was to protect the lives and property of just such money-grasping men as those in Bolivia that the United States Marines entered Nicaragua 15 years ago. They are still there. Having taken charge of the politics of that country, they have been careful to keep a conservative in the presidency. The admiral in charge, reporting to Washington, noticed that only 1/4 of the country was conservative, and that all of his actions were done against the will of 3/4 of the Nicaraguans. A fear for the sovereignty of Nicaragua and other Latin American nations was born. Other people began to think that no government could exist in Central America without the sanction of the United States. Some have resolved the differences between the North and the South into the eternal race and religion problems. Other people think that a solution of these questions and the realization of Pan-American ideals are hopeless. Such is the result of our sponsoring American capitalism. Whether we deny the intelligence of those thinkers, whether we label this thought as the wild ravings of radical minds, whether we discredit some or all of it does not and cannot make any difference at all. For, withstanding everything, it is there, omnipresent, growing, and becoming deeply rooted in the intellectual present and future of Latin America. Many have feared our interference in the past. Many will hate our intervention in the future, for the youth of the South is being taught to think. Is Latin America correct in calling our altruism masked imperialism? Should we continue to intervene in Latin America? What would the great men of our history do in this dilemma? Would not Lincoln champion the cause of the weak, but would not Roosevelt justify American intervention? What are we going to do? What ought we to do? One of the greatest blessings that the United States could receive in the near future would be to have her industries halted, her business discontinued, her people speechless, a great pause in her world of affairs created, and finally to have everything stopped that runs until everyone should hear the last wheel go round and the last echo fade away. Then, in that moment of complete intermission, of undisturbed calm, would be the hour most conducive to the birth of a Pan-American conscience. Then we should be capable of answering the question, what ought we to do? For we should be hushed and silent, and we should have the opportunity to learn that other people think. It is our task to consider Latin American thought and respect it. It is the produce of the mind of man, and in that it is truly great. With it, we must compare and contrast our thought. When the two are together, Latin and Anglo-Saxon, we must separate the just from the unjust. Our actions in the past have been neither continually praiseworthy, nor have they been constantly worthy of blame. And Latin Americans have not always been infallible in their thinking and comprehension of the present. Our southern neighbors must learn to accept our help in making themselves fit for self-government. We must learn that the day is coming when no one will need our aid. That day will be one of great responsibility for the United States. That day will witness one of the greatest tests that practical democracy has ever experienced. For if we should at that time continue to interfere in the affairs of any Latin American nation, other people would be convinced that the United States is imperialistic. On the other hand, if we should not do so, we and all of our actions in Latin America would be hailed as altruistic. Assuredly, our posterity must not be slandered as the devotee of a golden god. We must not follow in the ways of certain American capitalists, for only when we cleanse our hands of gold dust and share with the Latins of this continent an unselfish hand clasp will the sun of Pan-Americanism illuminate the horizon. Healed by the soothing rays of this sun, the Americans will prosper as never before. Economically, they will govern the world. Politically, they will prove that man can surpass misunderstanding. They will brilliantly prove that international life is not merely an ideal, but a reality. Spiritually, the Americans will teach all mankind. They will not give lessons in self-applause, for it attracts destruction. They will tell men of the science of appreciating, respecting, and sympathizing with others. Both Latin and Anglo-Saxon will have learned that other people think.
Thank you.